Good afternoon.
Thank you.
All right. Well, welcome to what I hope will be our first ever Investing in Early Childhood Summit. And I hope that it will be our first annual event, not first ever, it is our first ever, but I also hope it's going to be an annual event. It's far surpassed our expectations. And so just thank all of you for taking time to be here today. This I think you're in for a tremendous treat with Dr. David Kirp and Chris Boyd, who will be joining us in just a few moments. I wanted to say a couple of things. First, we want to thank our sponsors, Workforce Solutions, Dallas County, and MR and Evelyn Hudson Foundation, and the American Business Collaborative for helping make today possible. So please join me in thanking our sponsors. I'd also like to thank our conference partners, the Dallas After School Network, and Partners for Children, a coalition of the Foundation for Community Empowerment. Without their help, this would obviously not be possible. So thank you to both of our partners. And obviously, as all of you, and I know many of you are my fellow conference goers and planners, you know that this doesn't happen all by itself. And so special thanks also to the staff of Child Care Group, many of whom are here today. They actually are getting to sit down and eat lunch, which is unusual when you are the conference planner. So thank you. And I would like to say most particularly thank you to Mayor Cox from our staff at Child Care Group, who is the genius behind the development of this great day. So thank you all. As many of you know, as I said, particularly my fellow early childhood professionals, this isn't the first time we've kind of come together. In fact, we've kind of been pulling ourselves together for years and talking about what a big deal and how important it is to invest in young children. And wouldn't it be great if the rest of the world knew what we knew? And this is a little different this time because there's some unusual partners here. You know, it's not just the choir we're singing to this time. We're not all the early childhood people, although there are many of us here. There are many of our other community partners here as well, and our supporters, civic leaders, community leaders, business leaders, and that's what makes this so significant because we know it takes all of us to make a difference. And as I said, I've been coming to these kind of things, and I will say, someone asked me again this morning, did you found Child Care Group? Are you the founder? I have to say one more time, Child Care Group was founded in 1901. And while I am very flattered to think that someone would think I would found that organization, I did not. I've just been there 3 years, I promise. But I had to say, it tickled me a bit when she asked me that this morning because I thought, well, you know, it sort of feels like 100 years that we've been doing this kind of stuff. And like I personally have been involved trying to pull us together under the big tent. And together with all of the different sectors and all of us working together, that's what we've got today. So that's a tremendous opportunity. We've got everybody kind of on the same page. We've got that window of opportunity. And so I hope you will take the advantage today to listen, to think, to question, and to go forward, because that's what it's going to take. An opportunity is only as good as what we do with it when we walk out this door. So please take that opportunity to think, how are we going to continue to move forward so that we all believe so much that investing in our youngest children is the best investment around. What are we going to do about that? How are we going to keep that rolling forward? So thank you for that. Just briefly, I want to give a quick introduction to our main focus today. And then this afternoon, we will also have a panel of distinguished Texas experts in the field. So you've got a great afternoon in store. But first up is our conversation with Dr. David Kirp, facilitated by Chris Boyd of KERA's Think. David Kirp is the author of, which you will see, The Sandbox Investment, which we have over here, which David has graciously autographed. So after his talk, we'd be glad to get you a copy for $20 if you have a check or cash. If not, I will take an IOU because I know many of you and I could find you and I know you'd be good for the $20. So please take this book. It is a really compelling story. I was telling Dr. Kirp this morning, it's an exciting story for a service provider. It does not read like something, and please don't take this wrong, written by an economist, but it is a really what I would call a page turner. So thank you very much for sharing that with us. David is professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California at Berkeley. He's a former newspaper editor, which is probably why he writes so tremendously well as an academic, and his interests are range widely across post-social policy. He's written on a wide array of topics, including education, race, and gender discrimination, housing, AIDS, and civil liberties. And his books have been translated into numerous languages, including Chinese, Japanese, and Ukrainian. He contributes regularly to the national media, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Atlantic Monthly, American Prospect, and The Nation. And as I said, his newest book is The Sandbox Investment. Joining Dr. Kerp on stage is Chris Boyd, who I know is familiar to many Dallasites. She's host and managing editor of KERA 90.1's flagship midday show, Think. Chris joined KERA in 2001, hosting the nightly radio talk show Conversations. Later, she wrote and produced documentary and educational television programs, including the critically acclaimed national broadcast JFK, Breaking the News in 2003. Boyd also served as producer and co-host of the Emmy Award-winning public affairs program On the Record. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Kerp and Chris Boyd.
We'll start with this. David, how did this become an issue that you were specializing in?
Well, it's a good question because, as Susan suggested, I have kind of intellectual equivalent of attention deficit disorder. I've followed my passions and they've taken me to a whole array of domains. And there were really two things that sparked this. One of them was intellectual. I was taking a walk on the beach with a friend of mine who's a pediatrician, gone back to graduate school, and he said, this is fantastic research about preschool and the effects of preschool. And the last time I thought about preschool was back in the days of the Westinghouse study of preschool. And some folks in the room may remember that. This is where the dread phrase fade-out effect comes from. So I said to him, it's great that they're having these games, but it all fades out. And he said, no. And then he recited the facts of what some of you will know about as the kind of the iconic research in the field, the Perry Preschool Experiment. He said, no. It's not just the sort of effects in early years. It's what you see in this experiment is significantly fewer kids going to special ed, significantly fewer kids being left back in school. And for the statistics wonks among you, I mean statistically significant, which with a small number of folks is a big deal. More graduate from high school, more going to college, and then it really gets interesting because you get fewer people on welfare, more folks getting married, far fewer people going to prison for shorter terms, better self-reports of health, and an average income 25% higher at age 40 than those kids who otherwise similar hadn't gone to preschool. So, for a researcher, that's amazing. And then at another level, my then sister-in-law was struggling with a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old. Where was she going to send them? What kind of care or education could she get for them? And the choices were between a really bad sort of chain program, a kind of very much out-of-the-box cookie-cutter program, which was about a half an hour away from where she lived, or a kind of one-room living room program, run by the lady down the block. It's a very well-intentioned woman, but what you had is a bunch of kids underfoot. And if you actually looked at all the misspellings on the things that were on the wall, it didn't give you a whole lot of confidence. So I thought, what an amazing contrast, right, between what preschool can be and what preschool is. And that actually that got me to go out to the place where that great preschool had been, and one thing led to another, and here I am a few years later, and carrying on with what's become a real passion.
Why is it that 1 year, potentially, of education at the age of 3 or 4 can have such a dramatic impact on lifelong outcomes?
Well, let me back up for a second and say 1 year or 2 years of preschool is really important. But if anybody thinks it's a panacea, I've got a bridge to nowhere that I'm happy to sell you.
Thanks, but no thanks.
I mean, here's what ought to be in your heads as you think about preschool and early education. It's a line from John Dewey. What the best and wisest parents want for their children, that's what the society should want for all children. And that doesn't mean, you know, crappy care, you know, barely getting by childcare early on, and then, whoa, a year of great preschool with, you know, wonderful ratios and well-trained teachers, et cetera, and then terrible public schools. I mean, would you want your kids to go through that? So the reason early education can matter and the focus is on preschool because that's where the best research is because that's when kids' minds are developing in a very rapid rate. You know, I hate the image of kids as sponges because it's a kind of passive notion. There is this stuff out there and they absorb it. I think about kids as explorers. You know, think about them as the Lewis and Clarks of our society. All you got to do is watch them as they're learning all the time to get what that's about. And so to be in an environment where you have somebody who can pick up on that learning and help that learning along and turn that play into something that's joyful and, you know, advances their knowledge, that's really important. And the other big thing is words. Words, words, words. It's by the way, preschool is something, education program for 3 and 4 year olds can benefit all kids because there are a lot of middle class kids who wind up in kindergarten really underprepared for school and underperforming and will carry on that way through their school career. But if you really want to look at the best indicator of success, it's what kind of vocabulary do kids have? How many words do they know? And I was struck by this when I spent a lot of time crouching in classrooms when I was writing that book. And I was in the Chicago, University of Chicago Lab School preschool. Now, here's what you want to know about the University of Chicago Lab School preschool. It's like UT Austin's lab school, and I actually had the same conversation there. For those folks who really are into this in a serious way, you learn that you're pregnant, and the first call you make is to the preschool. Second call is to mom, and the third school is to your husband. Third call is to your husband. Okay, that's the kind of place it is. And here's a girl sort of sitting off by herself, and life is carrying on. And I said, "What's the matter?" And she said, "I lost my composure." And I thought, if only my colleagues had the same capacity for self-reflection as this four-year-old. Well, it turns out that kids like that have a bigger vocabulary than the welfare mom of that 3 and 4 year old. It turns out that kids who grow up in really poor circumstances come to school, come to age four, having heard 35 million fewer words spoken to them. Not different words, just words. And that gap, and the fact that, you know, the language is sad, mad, bad, glad, translates pretty directly into not great school performance, and then the problems build on each other. So if you can work with kids and with moms and dads, because preschool better be a partnership with parents, because parents are the people who are going to be really educating their kids. And I have met a parent who really didn't want to do best by his or her child. If you really work with both parents and those kids, you can narrow that gap. You can make life a whole lot. You can do good things for all kids, and you can do really good things for kids who are worst off. So you not only make everybody better off, you narrow those gaps that we have. Not a panacea, but a really important investment in those kids' futures.
Are parents of kids who go to preschool more likely to stay engaged with their children's education than those who just sort of started in kindergarten and went all the way through?
It's a great question, and I about which I have only anecdotal evidence. And my sense is this, that one of the things that differentiates preschool, if you look at what is it that makes a good preschool, on everybody's list, there's getting parents involved with their kids. If you look at most K-12 programs, parents are welcome on parent-teachers nights. Thank you very much. But they're not invited into the classroom. They're not really able to talk to the teachers a lot. So unless they somehow learn that they can really ask for things for their kids and for the other kids in their school, I think that that connection drops off. I mean, what you hope for is that at least parents are working with their kids and their homework at night and making, you know, and paying attention to that part of their lives. But in terms of actually connecting to the schools, many, many schools are just not welcoming places. And that's one of the things that I think K-12 can learn from preschool. I was in a meeting like this, and somebody from a school board said, how do we teach those preschool folks how to get our, how to sort of get these kids with the kind of skills that they need? How do we, because they're not so well trained, how do we impart this to them? And I said, you know, with respect, there's a heck, if you go to a preschool class, you go to a good preschool class, you see the best teaching that you're ever going to see. And, you know, there's a teachable moment every 10 seconds in those classes. You know, Mary and Johnny are sort of fighting over there for who is it that's got control of the, you know, the stethoscope when they're playing sort of doctor and nurse. And, you know, Susie is crying because she wants to go home, and Billy is throwing up in the corner, and how do you get him out of the, you know, out of the classroom, you know, out of that room and take care of him and take care of that. It's a remarkable experience. I truly don't know how people do it, and I particularly don't know how they do it for the kind of wages that many of them get. So I think there's a ton to be learned, including parent involvement, a ton that preschool can teach K-12. And one of the problems with our education system is that when you get beyond that level, when you get beyond kindergarten teachers who are really kid-focused, teachers become more interested in the academics. And there's a hierarchy in that system. You know, sixth grade teachers are more valued than third grade teachers, and junior high teachers all want to become senior high teachers so they can teach those subjects. And a lot of senior high school teachers think, gee, if only I were in the community college. So they're all pointed in that direction. And so here you've got people who are very kid focused, which I think is another lesson that K-12 can learn.
We've been operating with the notion that a good preschool is absolutely a place where the parents become engaged. But a lot of people would argue that K-12 would be much better if every parent were fully engaged. Does it still work? Do the values that children derive from going to preschool still count if the parents can't be brought in, if they just drop their kids off in the morning and pick them up in the afternoon?
Well, I'd agree with the notion that parents ought to be invited into schools all the way through. You know, fast forward to the kind of, you know, SHOP program, vocational ed programs. You've got lots of moms and dads who've got skills that would be awfully useful to those kids. Or you've got a writing program, and there's somebody out there who does technical writing for a computer program or works for a radio station or a TV station or what have you. There's lots of parent resources that schools don't take advantage of. Here's what I think explains the Perry preschool story, or the success story, where I don't have a sense that those parents were deeply engaged. And there, by the way, the teachers spent a half a day with those parents every week, sort of working with them, sort of making them allies in the education process. I think what happened is those kids came to school ready to learn and excited about learning and comfortable in the classroom environment. And the teachers pick that up. The teachers pick that up and they respond to that. And the kids respond to the fact that they're getting positive reinforcement. And you get this process that goes on back and forth. So the kids aren't starting out in school branded as failures. You know, and that, I think, sort of carries along. It's not the case, by the way, that IQ scores went up for these kids at Perry preschool. There's no effect on IQ scores. And, you know, people say, gee, that shows the program is a failure. And I say, so what? I mean, so quick show of hands, how many of you know your IQ scores? or the IQ scores of the people who you trust out there in life to do things. I don't know, maybe in this crowd there are some folks who are members of Mensa, that, you know. But it's just not a very interesting artifact. You know, a lot has to do with sort of what you do with your brain and how you're able to sort of make yourself master and mistress of your own world. And that's what I think happened. And yeah, it would have been better if the parents were involved, but I think that teachers pick up on this and kids pick up on this, and there's a way of resisting that process of disengagement. If you're in a school system, you see poor and black and Latino kids, many of them just beginning to get disconnected from school because school doesn't hold anything for them that they see that's of value. And they, you know, it's either they're going to go to work, or they've got some bunch of folks in the community, or they've got something else that's going to draw their attention. And if they've gotten into the mold of enjoying learning, it's a different situation. There's a real pushback in that story.
So in a state like Texas, where we don't have universal preschool available, that label can be applied to just about anything. It can be, as you mentioned, the lady next door who's well-intentioned but sort of runs a babysitting service. It can be a high-quality academic program. What do you want to see? What needs to be in terms of resources inside the classroom, and what kind of education does a teacher need to have to label a room an effective preschool classroom?
Well, I want to broaden the frame a little bit and talk about early education. And I think it's more than a matter of branding. If you talk about childcare with respect, you've lost the battle already. Because childcare means safe, warm place. You ask folks to talk about, what does childcare conjure up? It conjures up protection. It conjures up, and in our present world, it conjures up a place where you can stash kids while moms work. And they're not always safe, by the way. The data is pretty depressing. Even among licensed childcare centers, one in eight of those centers, did a national survey of licensed centers, one in eight of those centers are unsafe for kids. Right? They can fall down the stairs, they got wiring exposed, they got bad plumbing. Some basic standard isn't being met. And who knows what the data would look like if you added the unlicensed centers. If you start talking about early childhood education, you acknowledge the fact that kids are learning from the very start. It's not as though learning, you know, it's kind of like blob, 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 age four, little Einstein. You know, it's not like that. What kind of a world would I imagine? It's one that looks a little bit like what North Carolina has done with its Smart Start program, and where I'm hoping that Texas might actually be going. You develop a set of standards for okay, good, really good, outstanding early education. They're going to be different for the infants and the toddlers and the preschoolers. But there are standards, and they're out there. You don't have to invent them, although Texas, I think, is probably big on inventing things for its own. But, you know, that's fine. And you provide differential per pupil, per kid reimbursements to those programs. So there's a reason for the program to get better. And I have also never met the operator of a childcare center of a preschool that didn't want to do the best job that he or she could do by those kids. You know, and there's a limit to what you can do if your resources are so crummy that you're paying what childcare workers get paid, which is about $8.50 an hour. That is less than you make in McDonald's, and it's why the turnover rate in childcare centers is higher than for any other field except gas station attendants. You know, that, by the way, says a whole lot about how we as a society tacitly valued our kids, right? Care about, you know, whether our McDonald's burgers are cooked more than we do about whether our kids are, you know, in good shape. So you create a system, you create a tiered system which includes, you know, better trained teachers, smaller classrooms, teachers' aides, the kind of learning materials around that classroom that are really going to incite kids to get excited about stuff. And you provide some funds so that in advance the operator of those programs can build, if building is what's needed, so they don't have to make a capital investment on their own. And then you educate parents. You get the message across to parents in a whole bunch of ways, from media targeted to particular communities, particular ethnic groups, to community meetings, to a whole network of what's called viral marketing. This is why it matters. And then you give parents the choice. You say to parents, you can pick any, if you want to use state money, you can get a voucher that'll let you go to a pretty good, a good, a very good, and an excellent program. And you trust the parents at the end of the day. And if you look at what happened in North Carolina, and it really was this migration from not so okay to really good, because there was, incentive on both sides, right? Supply and demand changes, and the supply curve changes for the business folks in the room. So you get better childcare without somebody dictating it. And I want to say that early education and particularly preschool shouldn't be the province of any one institution. So my model of what a good preschool system is, that I want to walk into that classroom, and the first thing I'm going to look for is whether those kids come running over to me or stick around doing what they're doing. If they come running over to me, it's a bad class. I mean, I may be an interesting guy, but I'm not that interesting a guy, right? I don't think, if there's a four-year-old around here, I think The Simpsons would be a whole lot more fun than this. If they've learned about working and playing well with others, they'll look up and say hello, or they'll be, they'll be introduced, and back they go to their work. And you'll see interesting things in that classroom, and children engage in interesting things, and the teacher or teachers and teacher aide working with those kids. And then if you hang around for a while, you look at that, you ask the teacher, so when that particular moment happened, when there was this tussle over the stethoscope, or this kid was frustrated building, a railroad train out of blocks because he didn't have enough blocks, or whatever, what were you doing? What were you trying to do when you went over to those kids? What was in your mind? And it's not as though there's a right answer to that question, but there ought to be an answer to that question. A teacher ought to be aware of what she or he is doing when they're interacting with kids, other than surviving. So that's what I think of as a good preschool classroom. It's a little more, and it'd actually be a pretty good model adapted to younger kids as well. And I don't care what the sign on the building says. I don't care if it says public school or private school or nonprofit program or for-profit program or church program, or I don't care. Well-trained teachers understand kid development, kids engaged, small groups so that there's time to work with those kids. That's what the model is. And I absolutely trust parents, if they want to keep their kid at home and educate that child at home. They've got the time and can do that, and that's what they want to do. I'd wish for those parents that they'd see that there are some real benefits in kids being with other kids. All that waiting online, taking your turn, sharing stuff, and just the kind of connections that children make across lines. That's important. But the message isn't everybody ought to go to preschool or everybody ought to go to some institutional setting or some center, at age whatever. It's that ought to be a choice, and there ought to be a real choice available to those folks.
Right now, outside of government-administered programs, the vast majority of teachers working to provide early childhood education are not, not only do they not have specialized early childhood education degrees, many of them don't have degrees at all. Is there still a place for those who are possibly very gifted at what they do to work in a system like that?
Well, let me say a couple of things about that. In New Jersey, by court order, kids in the poorest school districts had to have available high-quality pre-K, which meant licensed teachers. And there weren't enough of those by any means around. So what happened? I mean, what happened is that the state provided money to pay for the tuition for those programs and brought the teaching programs to the communities. Didn't require that people drive 50 miles. but you could be in your community and there'd be some classroom after school weekend sometime that would actually work. And something like 90% of those people in the course of 5 or 6 years actually got a degree. So that's one, you know, my comment about parents and about people who run preschools is absolutely, I mean, you do not go into the preschool business either as somebody running a center or somebody who's teaching it for money, right? That's the I've got news for you line, right? You just don't, right? In case any of you sort of think about this as the route to instant riches, you know, I think the oil business is a lot more promising possibilities for you. But teachers want to get better. And the other thing I would point to is what's gone on in Texas with Susan Landry and the TEAM program. I think it's a really interesting model for how you work within the reality that a state is not anytime soon going to have all people who are teaching, you know, little kids with degrees. And it's a, you know, the model is a sort of year-long virtual education where what you're getting is not talking heads, but you're getting classroom situations with, you know, teachers with high school degrees, and then you stop the tape and you've got somebody there in the room with those folks. You have a conversation as to what was that teacher trying to do and was she any good at it or not so good at it? And then you get out of that program and the newly trained teacher goes into the preschool class or the early childhood education class, and there's a mentor teacher who really sees, helps her or him work through what's going on for those first months, because it's one thing to see it and talk about it, obviously it's another thing to do it. Well, I don't want to call that a good enough program, but it's a heck of a lot better than what goes on in, say, Florida, where, you know, all it takes to open your own preschool is a high school degree, a couple of courses, and no conviction for moral turpitude. You know, I used to say if you could stand up and breathe, you could run a preschool in Florida. And, you know, I've removed the stand-up part of this because there are certainly people in wheelchairs who can breathe and who can run preschools just fine there. And if you want to know how not to run a preschool system, you do what, you know, when Kansas was thinking about, the Kansas folks were beginning to think about preschool, the advocates there did a very smart thing. They took the governor to visit Florida. And so the motto in Kansas becomes, not like Florida. It's pretty commonsensical. If you keep in your head that notion of what the best and wisest parent would do, that isn't what you do. You know, and you walk into those places and the TV is on and the, you know, the that's it, basically, and the kids are sitting around and there's nothing for them to do, and that's preschool. That's a nightmare. So I can't emphasize more how important quality is. This is not a world in which, you know, kind of classic business model, invest a little, get a little back, invest a little more, get a little more back. Uh-uh. Invest a little, get nothing back. Invest, you gotta invest a fair amount to get really good returns. And the kind of returns that the studies are showing are the kind of returns that would get Warren Buffett interested. Lori Taylor, who teaches at the Bush School, Republican, worked for the Federal Reserve, economist, did a study looking at this set of data. And what I've just given you is her conclusion about what it takes to get high-quality early education in Texas. So it's not a partisan point, you know? It's a really common sense point. You know, just think about where you'd want your child and whether you think that other kids are somehow less worthy for some reason. I mean, what did a 2-year-old do to deserve this? So a Texas story, right? Texas requires that preschool teachers be licensed. Most preschool goes on in the public schools. But there are no class size limits for preschools in Texas. So I walked into a preschool classroom with a licensed teacher in front of the room, 40 kids. Think about it, 40 kids. I thought of Lord of the Flies when I walked in there and nobody wanting to be Piggy. You know, just, and you know, there's some data that says, you know, you spend too much time you know, in child care centers and you wind up aggressive. Well, look at that environment. You want to, man, if you want to survive, you better learn something about being aggressive. Is that really the best that the state of Texas can do for its kids?
David, with 40 plus years of evidence that this works if it's done properly, have you come to any understanding of how we've managed to sort of ignore this for so long and pretend that this isn't a sort of a valid part of every child's education?
You know, I had one of the things I had fun doing in writing the book was being an historian. So I went back 60 years, 65 years, and looked at Henry Kaiser's child care, child parent centers at the Portland, Oregon shipyards, World War II. And, you know, if you read that chapter in the book, kind of your jaw drops at how serious he was. And by the way, one of the reasons that he was serious is pretty practical. He paid teachers who were there a fair amount of money because otherwise they're going to migrate and work in the shipyards, you know, which is where the jobs are for them. The guys are overseas fighting and those are the women who are there. And, you know, here are women coming cross country to work in these shipyards and they want to make sure their kids get something good. I mean, that down to the design of the size of the desks and the building, which is a bunch of rooms around a wonderful open play courtyard, to the dietitian who's thinking about meals. You know, I used to say when I talked about this that the only thing you might change is that those kids got a dose of cod liver oil every day, which I remember as a punishment threat, you know. But how many of us actually are now taking little fish liver oil pills, those little capsules? What do you think that is? Just rebranded cod liver oil, you know, a little plastic around it. So even the cod liver is a good thing. So we've known forever. I mean, you can go back to Froebel, the guy who invents kindergarten. You know, put Froebel in charge of your state pre-K program, you're going to have a pretty good program. So the knowledge is there for a very long time. What's begun to happen, right, or what's happening? You have the brain research, which has really been, you know, sort of seeped into the general public's attention in the last 10, 15 years. You get these long-term studies, and economists beginning, which show these profound effects, and then you get economists translating the benefits of those programs into dollars and cents terms. And so, you know, you hear numbers, like Perry Preschool produced a 17-to-1 return on investment. Now, I gotta tell you, that doesn't feel right, feels high to me. And it's also not gonna happen again because in those days it was Perry Preschool or the streets. There's no Head Start, there was no nothing for those kids. Now, kids are someplace. But let's assume that number was off by a factor of 4. 4-to-1 returns. Hey, I'll take 4-to-1 returns. You know, you take a look at what the rate of return is on a lot of things that you're spending money on. It's not going to come close to that. I can't think of another program that would match that in terms of return on investment. So you get that. And what are the economists come up with that research, and then they get the business community interested. I'm delighted to hear that the Chamber of Commerce is here. The Chamber of Commerce is here in part because, you know, they're business people with hearts. They care about kids. They also care about making smart investments. You know, so when they hear that Warren Buffett sent his daughter out, gave her a chunk of money and said, you go find a way to spend money in the public service sector that's the equivalent, make a social investment that's equivalent to the kind of investments that I do, and she comes up with an early education program. You know, that tells you something. When Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, says preschool is a really smart investment, when the Business Roundtable says preschool is a smart investment, that just changes the conversation. And then, you know, there's the most unlikely ally of all. You get an organization called Fight Crime, Invest in Kids forming up. And who are they? They are police chiefs, sheriffs, and district attorneys across the country. You know, what are they promoting? After-school programs and preschool. Why? It's a kind of like that old ad, you know, pay me now or pay me later. They do not want to be dealing with 15-year-olds and putting them in jail. It's not a policeman's dream. And they can look at the data and see that providing that kind of support early and then continuing with after-school programs is going to make a difference in those kids' lives. When you get police chiefs and DAs and businessmen and pediatricians and elementary school teachers and elementary school principals and school superintendents, many of whom will say, you know, if I had my choice, I'd take the money that I spend on 12th grade, shut down 12th grade, and put in preschool. The only reason you have 12th grade, and this is particularly true in this state, is football, right? If it wasn't, as long as it's football, there will always be a senior year in high school. But you got a whole bunch of allies, and it's hard now to find anybody on the other side of the story. The other side of the story is how you do it. You can call anything, as you were, you can call anything preschool and get away with it. And, you know, the job of the people in this room, you know, if you accept the argument that preschool, good preschool matters, is to not be satisfied that you've got a bill in the state legislature or you've got some money which generous foundations are contributing to make a program happen. You really have got to work to make sure that it's a good program. And this is also where parents come in. Because you want to educate parents so they can push to be knowledgeable consumers and to make real demands of the system for their kids, just the way middle-class parents make demands on the system for their kids.
Yeah, what changes about a program like Head Start, for example, if it's made available to children regardless of income?
Well, Ed Ziegler, who is one of the inventors of preschool, I mean, he's such an eminent guy in this field that there is a center at Yale called the Edward Ziegler Center for Child Development and Public Policy. And it's really rare that Yale University names something for anybody who isn't dead. So he gets to be alive to enjoy this fact. And it's a tribute to what an important figure he is in the field. And, you know, his lesson over all those years, very pithy, programs for poor people are poor programs. So it's not an accident, you know, that Head Start has been underfunded since it began. I mean, and it's, you know, so that fewer than 50% of the eligible kids for Head Start can go to Head Start programs. And early Head Start, which there's really pretty good data that says if you provide center-based, good quality early education and you get parents involved, you know, that combination, you make a difference for these kids. And the data are pretty good on this. You know, they get something like $500 million, $500 million. They get to serve about 3% of the eligible kids. Why? Because, you know, we still live in a world in which you get middle class folks interested and engaged, then things begin to happen. You know, cases in point, Social Security, Medicaid, right? Most effective domestic lobby that we got, AARP. Why? Because they, across the board, seniors are really clear about what they want. They want Social Security intact, they want Medicaid, and they want drug benefits. That's it. And they mobilize, and they vote. And here, I mean, one of the interesting things is that grandparents become another constituency in this enterprise. I mean, a lot of folks I know have a great time as grandparents, such a great time, they kind of wish they could have skipped the parent stage entirely and gone straight to being grandparents. Parents have, you know, they've got a lot of stuff on their plate, and the thought that they're actually going to get involved in some political activity, really hard to pull off for most parents. Making a living, raising family, buying a house, holding on to the house. But grandparents get to see, you know, what's happening to their children from a little bit of a distance, and they really do have the energy and the capacity to work politically on behalf of those kids. So that's another group that I think sort of comes into this story as well. So we're at a point in which all the elements are in place, all the research elements are in place, and you've got in this state some amazingly effective advocates for preschool, including Jason Sabo, who you'll hear from later, and you know, I know this place pretty well because Jason and I got in his pickup truck and we drove the length of Congressional District 17, which is the district that runs from Waco down to College Station, And it's Chet Edwards' district. Kind of amazing, and it's his district in some part because he was for the kids. And it's a very interesting kind of political lesson that sort of says this is an issue whose time is coming, not just rhetorically, but in reality. If a state like Texas does not invest in high-quality programs for kids now, it's going to lose out later on. It's just as simple as that. And it doesn't get to sit on its hands and say, hey, we've done great things for 3- and 4-year-olds. But, you know, this is not a new idea in Texas. I mean, Ross Perot was pushing high-quality education 20-some years ago in this state. This is where no pass, no play comes from. But there really does need to be a focus on this, and not, you know, it's us versus them. You know, give money to preschool and you're not giving money to childcare and you're not giving, and the, you know, you're threatening the livelihoods of various people, and if you don't give money, you give money to 0-5, and the, you know, the K-12 folks are worried because you're not going to give money to them. You know, this state is in a rare position of having money. I come from California, which, if you don't know it, is trying to, you know, we're now 3 months and counting, 2.5 months, in a non-budget year with an $18 billion deficit, 1 year, $18 billion deficit. You know, we can think about planning and little ideas and quality standards. This is really a window of opportunity for a state that is now prosperous to put in place and to institutionalize really good, high-quality early education, so that you take it as for granted as you take kindergarten. Same fights, by the way, went on 50, 60 years ago over universal kindergarten. And some of those fights still go on in some places. You know, 120 years ago, there were folks who talked about, you know, high school, what we ought to have is, they call it pauper high schools. Nobody was mincing words in those days. You know, that's where we provide high schools for paupers. Everybody else gets to pay for their own education. Well, that seems long ago. You know, I just hope that this is a moment in which that process can get speeded up here.
You spoke earlier about the Chamber of Commerce being here. I'm wondering if you know how effectively the existence of universal preschool has been in luring companies that want to relocate to the states where that does exist.
It's a really good question. I think if you've got companies that need brain power, that's what they rely on, and increasingly that's what companies need. They're going to have young folks who are either single and about to get married or married with little kids. And one of the things they go look at is what's available for my family in this community. And that starts, you know, they're going to go back to work on average before that kid is 6 months old, maybe a whole lot earlier. What's available all the way across the board? You know, in that state to the northeast of you that will remain nameless, one that used to have more oil than it does now. You know, they had a preschool program, a universal preschool program in place, available, the money available in the mid-1990s. And there are a lot of superintendents in Oklahoma who said, you know, whoops, I mentioned the name of that state. you know, said, oh, we don't need to do this. We'll take the money and put it elsewhere. And parents started migrating out of those districts into places which did have preschool. They got the message. And, you know, in Oklahoma, you know, whose the motto of sort of social reformers in Oklahoma is thank God for Mississippi. In Oklahoma, it's true. It's a task. In Oklahoma, southeast Oklahoma was the worst off part of the state, and you had communities there that were investing in full day preschool, pre-K, out of their own pockets. And lo and behold, in the third grade tests, you know, they had 95% of their kids were doing at or above average. And then you get parents from the rich suburbs of Oklahoma City and Tulsa where their kids aren't doing as well, and they say, hey, what gives? So there really is a dynamic built into this story in which you get, you know, the kind of workers that brain companies, the computer companies, and the, you know, the high-tech companies generally want. looking around and saying, you know, what's there, and what can I afford for my children? And if you're in a place where, you know, you're starting out, and if house prices are pretty high, and you've got a couple of kids, you can't just reach into your wallet and keep shelling out the money to do this. And you shouldn't be expected to. That ought to be part of our compact with those families, just as good public schools ought to be part of our compact with those families.
So in a system where we now expect accountability, and we expect it to be measured in a certain way, the best preschools are not flashcard farms where the kids are drilling on things and learning algorithms at the age of 3 or 4. How do you ensure that whoever's in charge of giving out this money can feel as if there are significant gains being measured?
Well, this is very fraught territory. I'll tell you another story. This one from Chicago, which has lots of really good preschool programs, interesting preschool programs in Chicago. I spent a fair amount of time there, and Chicago is much of the first chapter of the book is Chicago. But in one of those programs, the city of Chicago mandates a test for all preschool kids. And so you had a child who turned 3 in September taking this test in November. And the test begins with holding up a block, what is this, triangle, circle, square, etc. And then it's take this block and put it into the hole, you know, on the board, fit the circle into the circle. And then it was draw a circle, and then it was, you know, write your name. And with each task, each thing got more difficult. This kid was just getting more and more uncomfortable. I watched him like this, gnawing at his knuckles. This is brilliant. Test anxiety in a 39-month-old child. That's what we've done. So I get very nervous about, you know, what it is that we're looking at. A lot of what we're looking at ought to be teacher observation stuff, and there are ways of dealing with that. And a lot of what we ought to be focusing on is how do you improve what's going on? What can you do to help the teachers in that classroom? And it's important to take the emotional temperature of those kids as well as the, you know, how many words does the child know and how many letters does she recognize? You know, some really hardcore data on this from Jim Heckman, who is an economist, University of Chicago, Nobel Prize winner, who's made early education his big issue, looked at children who at age 3 had done very well on cognitive tests and very well on a different, you know, group of kids who did really well on the socio-emotional adjustment tests. And they had done okay on the academic tests, and the first group had done sort of okay on the social-emotional. If you looked down the road, at age 18, the kids who had really stood out in the academic stuff were doing somewhat better academically. Not as much better as you might think, but better. But the kids who'd done really well on the social-emotional thing, well, they were less likely to be pregnant as teens, less likely to be in trouble with the law, less likely to be smoking or drinking or doing drugs. Well, you know, this isn't some kind of mushy guy. I mean, this is a person who writes, you know, who uses the entire Greek alphabet many, many times over to sort of create his formulas. That's what he won the Nobel Prize for, was the rigor of the analysis. So he's entirely credible character. And if he's saying, you know, pay attention, pay as much attention to that stuff, that's a really important thing to be about. I'm really, there's a very fine line between, you know, wasting money by just sort of sending it out there into the world and creating a world of no preschooler left behind. And the kind of skill and drill that you describe is something that a lot of preschools think they've got to do if they're going to get those kids ready for that test and meet those accountability standards. And unfortunately, a lot of parents have soaked this up as well. So even if the preschool teacher wants to do, say, the Reggio Emilia method of preschool teaching, which I particularly like a lot, It's a lot of hands-on, a lot of art-centered. You walk into the room, it's all natural stuff, lots of plants, kids' drawings and paintings around the room, and it's not, I mean, kids being photographed, what they're doing, the photographs going home to the families in the class, projects growing out of what kids are interested in. You know, there are lots of books around, and there's lots of, you know, all the kind of stuff that you, but you're playing on those kids' natural curiosities, and you're expanding those curiosities. It's really, you know, worrying that that teacher feels, I really can't do this, because I'm not sure that those kids are going to score well on that narrow band test that that Chicago bureaucrat thinks we need to impose on all preschool kids in November to make sure that they're on the mark. It's very complicated business to figure out ways of evaluating that are sensitive to the development, appropriate, developmentally appropriate, have built-in diagnostics that will help the teachers work with particular kids and help mentors work with the teachers. But that's the goal.
So is the more holistic mission of preschool an argument for keeping universal preschools off regular elementary school campuses where the culture may be sort of permanently attuned to teaching to the test?
Well, you kind of hope, this is what I was saying before, that the preschool spirit would work its way up the ladder. Because, I mean, what winds up happening with teaching to the test is this. You get good third grade scores if you teach to the test. Because the third grade test is basically about decoding words and decoding symbols. And that's what a lot of the skill and drill programs look like. But you don't get great results in the eighth grade and the 11th grade tests. Because there's much more thinking involved in those tests. And that's not what you're learning about is thinking. I mean, here's another little sobering piece of data. The curriculum that was used in Perry Preschool, that's the experiment study, continues to be used in this HiSCOPE program. And the researchers conducted a little experiment. They had three pre-K classrooms, kids randomly assigned. One was the HiSCOPE program, which is summarized as plan, do, review. Kids sit down, figure out what they're going to do. There are a bunch of places in the classroom that they can do stuff. Then they go do it. Teachers are helping and wandering around. And then they come back together and they review what they've done and what they've learned during the day. And then there was a classic nursery school play-based model. And there was also a very skill and drill model. So, and then they study the kids along the way up to age 15. And what they found was, you looked at first grade, the skill and drill kids were doing better on the skill and drill stuff. But that difference faded out over time. Indeed, you know, it was kind of a wash down the road with all those programs. But if you looked at, you know, who'd gotten in trouble with the law, the skill and drill folks were much more likely to have gotten in trouble with the law. And the theory behind that makes some sense. If you're in a classroom-directed, teacher-directed classroom, you learn how to follow orders really well. And as long as you've got a good person giving those orders, you're fine. When you're 15, you know, maybe it's the 17 or 18-year-old that you're listening to, and I'm not sure that those are the orders that you want. If you're in a nursery school, regular nursery school, or, you know, a program like Reggio Emilia or HiSCOPE, you're learning to think for yourself. So you can think for yourself. That's at least a hunch as to why that works.
So let's talk about the forces that oppose this. I think it's the worst idea. They think David Kerp wants to let the government raise my kids.
Well, it's really interesting. Look at the Republican National Convention and the adulation given to a woman who has raised five kids, and for a good chunk of the time, she's been in public office. She just had a child with Down syndrome, and she tells us she's back at work 3 days later. And there is no one at that convention who's batting an eye. And indeed, if somebody raises the question, it's absolute sexism. Women should be able to do, moms should be able to do what they want. And I think that's an important moment because I think that social conservatives are coming to terms with the reality that more women are like our vice presidential running mate, Sarah Palin, than they are like the stay-at-home mom, you know, who gets to, you know, be with her kids and for 4 years. I remember being in a Washington TV radio show, and this woman is saying, you know, well, I don't know why I need preschool. We've got a big ranch here, and the horses are out back, and the kids can go gallop along, you know, the back 40. And I said, you know, I'll bet you there are parents out here who just love to take their kids out to, but, you know, ma'am, with respect, that is not an option that's available to most families. And I think this moment is really a turning point moment in that. I think it's really hard to make the case when the average mother, not the average poor mother, the average mother is back at work well before her child is 6 months old. So you've got to do something with those kids. And as families spread, there's not always a grandma around, there's not a sister around or a brother around or an uncle around to take up the slack. Got to have something for those kids. And, you know, more and more as parents get the brain research, you know, the neighbor lady down the street isn't enough. It certainly isn't enough when the kids are, you know, 2 and 3 years old. So I don't think the question is, will there be early education? But I think that issue is over. If you can get governors in places like Nebraska and Oklahoma running on high-quality programs for two-year-olds, used to be the third rail of politics, if you can do that, I think the battle is over. I think the battle is about quality. If I'm a politician, I am in the business, a very important thing to me, maybe the most important thing to me, is to claim credit for something. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. I mean the straight factual sense. I'm going to run for office. I got to be able to say I accomplished this. Okay. So we got two candidates, you know, two different states. One of them says, you know, while I was governor, 150,000 kids were added to the pre-K rolls. The other one says, while I was governor, you know, we got pre-K classes down at 20, and there are two teachers in the room, and they've got a high-quality curriculum, and they've got this, and parents are involved, and, you know, their audience has gone to sleep someplace in the middle of that sentence. So for the politicians, the incentives are all numbers. They're all about numbers. And I'm hoping that I've begun to convince even the skeptics in this room that numbers are not only not enough, they're really a misleading measure, and it's all about quality. And so as a political political strategy for those people who really push, what I say is it's much easier to go from good to big than it is to go from big to good. I mean, Texas is trying to do the latter and is doing the latter, but it's a whole lot harder to turn around the ship while it's left the harbor than it is to build a ship right in the first place. And so each time a state adds on to what it's doing, it's really important that it pay attention to the quality of what it's adding on and not just focus on the, okay, how many kids are we taking care of so those moms can go to work and we're out of here.
So if you could lay out the sequence for Texas in developing a universally available preschool, what would happen from here on out?
I think that's a great question for the Texas panel to address itself to. I'm not a, you know, I know a reasonable amount about Texas, but I would be foolish to say I have enough of a grounding in what's happening now, what the political realities are to do that. Maybe that's why I'm not a politician.
I know that you don't like either or questions a lot. In other words, either we spend the money on K-12 or we spend it money on preschool. But I'm wondering if you come upon a lot of people who argue we should worry about universal health care before we get universal preschool.
Well, I, by the way, the folks who make the argument about you should worry about fixing K-12 before you fix preschool, the big group are the conservative foundations. You got one here in the State of Texas Public Policy Institute, is that what it's called? Foundation. You got, you know, the Goldwater Foundation. You have me just tangling with the Reason Foundation in California. You know, all these things are wrong with preschool, and there's a sort of little point counterpoint piece that they've been making the same just straightforward, misleading, misrepresenting arguments about the data for a long time. But then they say, we ought to spend the money on K-12. And I say, that's great. If you guys come up to Austin and say, let's expand the K-12 budget, hey, you know, you got a case, because you can certainly do a better job with K-12. And universal health care versus pre-K or early education, I have a very pragmatic answer to that question. It's all about the political window of opportunity. What are people ready to deal with now? When Bill Clinton was president in 1992, one of the sagest senators, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, said, welfare reform first, then health care. Welfare, then health. He tried it the other way around. You see what happened. In a given locale, if we're talking nationally, I mean, nationally, we've got a deficit to deal with, we've got a war to address, we've got a whole, you know, we've got health care to deal with. I mean, I think, you know, the national government has been missing an action on this issue since essentially forever. So something is going to have to happen in Washington. And by the way, I mean, we know that something will happen if Barack Obama is elected, and I would hope that something would happen if John McCain were elected, because, as I've been saying, this is not a red state, blue state issue. You know, you've got, you know, the governor of Alabama as the pre-K hero of the year for his support of preschool. You've got the governor of South Dakota dipping into the industrial development funds to start a pilot pre-K program. There's nothing. You've got Bobby Jindal next door committed to high-quality pre-K. This is not about, this is about smart, this is about doing well politically by doing good. And economists will say there is no $20 bill on the ground because if there were, somebody had already picked it up. I think particularly for the Republicans, there's a $20 bill on the ground called high-quality early education because nobody expects it. You know, it's what compassionate conservatism was going to be about, that kind of caring for others. So my hunch is that on the national level, you're going to get incremental change in early education, and you're going to get a larger change in healthcare, because the healthcare crisis, the money crisis is right out there. But at the state level, the answer is going to depend on what the political climate is of the state, what it is the legislators see as the most important thing for them to do, given what the situation is right now. Many states have come really close to having universal child health care. You know, we don't sort of think about this. That big fight over SCHIP, the child health insurance program, $35 billion over 5 years. I mean, $30 billion over 5 years, that's $6 billion a year. That is not a lot of money in federal budget terms. Why? Because, you know, in bits and pieces, states have actually managed to get something pretty close to universal child health care. So I don't, you know, I wouldn't want to make a choice between those two. And if somebody said to me, you know, it's really more important right now, let's get health care fixed. And I'd say, don't give up. Don't just stop. Don't, in that sense, don't make it either or. Just keep the ball rolling. Keep change happening. You know, this is a very, you know, you've got these astute advocates. And how did you get pre-K expanded in this state when everything else was being cut? Got a bill saying, you know, the little kids of people who are fighting in Iraq or who died in Iraq, coming back from Iraq, their kids deserve state pre-K. Okay, legislator, raise your hand if you're going to oppose that. It's not going to happen. You make incremental change. You advance high-quality programs any way you can. It can be the centerpiece. It can be one of the issues that's on the table, but you just keep the ball rolling. You don't forget kids.
It bears pointing out that you have never said that you think it should be mandatory for all children to attend. You just want it to be available to every child. But I'm curious about what's happened in the states where people might have said, we don't need this, we don't want this. Suddenly, when there is high-quality child education available, does everybody send their children?
Now you get about, in the states where the two states that have been at this longest and had universal pre-K longest, Georgia and Oklahoma, you get about 70% of the families sending their kids to that program. And my guess is you get a lot of parents sending their kids to child care centers of the neighbor next door or private pre-Ks or what have you. So I think that probably is a natural saturation point in terms of a public program. You know, this isn't France, you know, where, you know, a lot of childcare advocates and early education advocates go to France and think this is really fantastic. And indeed, you know, if you actually go into the classrooms, it's less fantastic than you might imagine because it is a much more skill and drill deference to the teacher's program. But I mean, there, you know, from the moment you have a baby and there is somebody who's going to visit you, it doesn't matter whether you're the president's wife or someone living in one of the slums of Paris, all the way through to the creche, to the Ecole Maternelle, the sort of preschool programs, there's a program, and everybody sends their kid to that program. Very little by way of private program. But that's a country with a totally different social tradition. You have to really go back a long ways to understand how that came to be. That isn't us. We really are a let a thousand flowers bloom country. And I think as long as those flowers have been well picked, well chosen, you know, as long as there aren't a whole lot of skunk weeds in the middle of that garden, that's great. Because if you make a guess on what anything, any good thing is, and you guess wrong, you're in trouble. But, you know, if you've got a world in which lots of different people think they have a great idea, and you let parents in on what it is that they're doing, and you find real language, informative language, not the kind of junk that usually parents get when they're choosing among schools, but real informative language, and you let parents actually go and visit the schools and talk to those teachers and see what's going on, I think we do better than would happen elsewhere.
What, David, is your dream for seeing this done right, and what would be the nightmare?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, the dream you've already, in a sense, the dream you've heard, it's, again, encapsulated what you would want for your kids, for all kids. And not a notion that there's something called child care, which is just child-minding, and preschool, which is all about academics, but that you're paying attention to the ways in which kids are developing socially, emotionally, you know, cognitively from early on, and in ways that involve parents and professionals who are trained to understand this. And I will tell you, I've also spent some time recently with nurses in the Nurse Family Partnership Program, going out teaching young parents about mothering. Oh my goodness, if you ever thought that parenting was somehow instinctive, I don't care who you are. If you can sign up for that program, do it. There's just an amazing ton of stuff, and I can say it, you know, that there's a lot of stuff to learn about parenting, but when you see it, you see the kind of signals, and what we know about the ways in which kids are signaling from, you know, from birth, what's going on with them. It's very sobering. So you want, ideally, move your way toward the best that you've got. The stuff that's proven to work, Nurse Family Partnership, which is sending nurses out to work, particularly with poor first-time moms all the way through age two. There's really good longitudinal data. That's kind of the Perry preschool program. But there are other programs that are less expensive that also have pretty good returns. Programs that you might call good enough, given the fiscal realities. And taking you on through, you know, a program like the Tulsa program, which is producing good results. It's not Perry preschool, but it's real people. You know, it's a community not so very different from lots of communities in Texas. That's the dream. The nightmare, you've also heard a bit. I mean, the nightmare is Florida. The nightmare is do it on the cheap and don't watch it and don't pay attention to it and let it just unfold in all of its sort of horrors. And it's a nightmare because, you know, 5-10 years down the road, some smart researcher is going to do a study of the effects of preschool in Florida. And what are they going to find? Nada, right? Worthless program, no effects. And think about what the reaction to that is likely to be on the part of those social conservatives you were asking before. You know, out loud they're going to say, you see, it's just more nanny state stuff. You know, they had their day. It's totally, you know, wrong-headed. You know, it's a waste of money. And then more softly, they're going to say, and besides, what can you really expect from those kids? So I've said that in rooms like this across the country, different kinds of audiences, different places along the way. I look around the room, teacher that I am, to see where people are. I have never seen a single face registering a blank as to what those people means. Everybody gets it. So I say that because the stakes are hugely high. You know, this is really about the future of the soul of this country, and it's about the future of the economy of this country. In that sense, I can't think of any single enterprise more important than being attentive to kids. Good healthcare is, to some considerable extent, about getting the money issue sorted out. We know what good healthcare is, and we are providing it to a fair number of folks. But treating kids well, not giving them the least amount of resources that we do for any age group in the country, that's about the future of the country, and it's about not giving the people on the other side of this question the chance to push back and say, you know, what can you expect of those kids? The people who are in the field, I have enormous admiration for you. You are doing God's work. The people who are in politics, who are allies, and the people who are in the Chamber of Commerce, who see the importance of this for the future of the community and the foundations, who are contributing money to make what sounds like a really promising neighborhood-based experiment, 0 to 5, happen. It's fantastic. And my only prayer for you, particularly the folks who are in the field, is that you find the energy to also do the kind of grassroots mobilizing and the state-level mobilizing. Illinois does the advocates in Illinois do this brilliant job. Every year they bring thousands and thousands, 30 to 50,000 parents show up on Kid Day at Champaign-Urbana. My favorite conversation that I heard about was a woman from south side of Chicago, an African-American woman who's buttonholing her legislator and says, "And we get better, more money for better preschools." And he said, "You know, I really wish I could do something, but it's just sort of out of my control." And she said, "So how do we elect somebody who can actually put in his control?" That's the kind of work that needs to be done to make these dreams a reality. Thank you very much. It's been great to be here.
Thank you again, Chris and David.